This is All Things Considered on WKU Public Radio. I'm Emil Moffitt. A novel called The Killing Jar by Gloria Nixon John is based on a true story from rural eastern Kentucky, in which an incredibly gifted but mentally disturbed 15-year-old boy is convicted of murdering his neighbor's 7-year-old daughter and assaulting the neighbor. The main character, named Ted Lynch in the book, spends several years as the nation's youngest person on death row until his murder conviction was thrown out on appeal. During the retrial, he's convicted of manslaughter and winds up serving 15 years in prison before being released to a mental institution and then a halfway house. The book is a novel, but the author says she started the project as a nonfiction presentation of the events. She says 95% of the book is based on factual documentation.
The psychologist that handled this case contacted me, and he said, you know, I have this story that's been haunting me, but I can't write. And he said, why don't you look at the story and see if you can start it for me, write a few pages for me, and then we'll talk. And I read two or three pages of this description of what was going on, and I was hooked.
And talk about the decision to write it as a novel as opposed to just a straight nonfiction account.
Right. I did start writing it as straight nonfiction, but I was very frustrated doing that because I'm a creative writer, and I even though my documentation was vast and I interviewed a lot of people for this writing, to create a picture, to paint a picture, I really needed to do it as narrative. And also, the person that I'm writing about, the young man who committed this horrible crime, was still alive at the time. I was afraid for him, and it was smart to be afraid for him. Because as soon as people found out I was writing about the case, I started to receive nasty and threatening mail.
Ted Lynch, the main character, his name in your book, grew up in very difficult circumstances. He was a lot of times malnourished, wasn't given a lot to eat. His mother appeared to be strictly religious but abusive at the same time. Talk about how that his childhood and his upbringing shaped him.
Well, amazingly, he was had a very high IQ and was winning awards for things at school and was doing extremely well. As he started to grow a little bit more and got into the teenage years and was being malnourished, a lot of things started to go haywire. He was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic at one point with delusions, but he wasn't being fed. There are examples in the history of his case where his mother would sometimes feed her children 2 slices of bread with peanut butter for the day. Amazingly enough, the Department of Social Services was allowing this woman to adopt and foster other children.
And they didn't have a lot to go on for their own children, but she kept bringing in other children.
Right. She brought in other children probably for the money, I don't know, used that money for something other than food, but all of them were deprived. And this particular young man, his life kind of is a profile of what can go wrong. I've studied a lot of child killers since I did this work. And everything was falling into place that would lead to violence, and nobody noticed it. In fact, the community, I blame the community for not just what he did, the victim. I blame the community for what happened to the victim, but I blame the community for not intervening.
Let's talk a little bit about his first trial. His first trial, what kind of representation did he have? And what was the prosecution like on both sides of the issue?
Well, I tell people it was like a circus because the trial was held in the community in which the crime occurred. Everyone knew the judge. The judge was, in fact, related to some people involved in the case. Teachers in the community brought elementary school children in to watch the proceedings, to listen to the details of the crime. The psychologist was threatened. The defense attorneys were threatened. So it reads like something out of an earlier time in America, like a lynching rather than a trial. It's just outrageous to me.
And you mentioned the psychiatrist who examines and diagnoses him and speaks with him for a number of hours. You mentioned that he was threatened, and it seems like a lot of people at that time didn't buy into mental disorders. How do you think things would be different if this case were in 2014 as opposed to 1978?
Well, the laws have changed since, so he wouldn't have been charged with a capital offense. But I'm not so sure things would be all that different in certain communities in America. And I don't just mean Kentucky. I think there are pockets of communities in this country where something very similar would happen. And a lot depends on who you can afford to represent you. That's what startles me the most when I look back at the research I did and I look at the law right now, because we do still have young people who committed crimes when they were juveniles and are now sitting in prison for life.
Late in the book, after Ted Lynch is convicted of manslaughter, he's sent to general population, which he finds deplorable in comparison to death row. Nixon John's description of that scene fascinated me, so I asked if she would read the passage.
It is true that the men on the row are the best behaved in the place. He had heard that, and now knows it is true. Perhaps the men in general population are different because they have hope, and with that hope comes defiance, straight up or subtle. Yes, that's it. He sees defiance even on the faces of those who are doing 25 to life.
In the years between his trial, he's one of the youngest, sometimes the youngest, person on death row in the United States. It almost seems like, reading the book, that was his time on death row was some of the more peaceful time in his life.
I'm so glad you picked up on that. A lot of people miss that. And I did 7 years of research before I wrote this book, and I did interviews, on death row with men that are serving there. And they confirmed what I suspected, and that was this was the only time this young man felt truly loved. Other than the time he spent with his grandmother, the men there on death row really treated him as a young man who needed to be protected. I'm sure there were risks and some dangers there for him, but if he needed something, they provided it, especially intellectual nourishment, if you can believe that. I believe that now because I know men serving on death row in Kentucky. And I can tell you that sometimes I feel that they are, one or two of them, more spiritual than I am. I've learned from them, and it's changed my life.
We've been visiting with Gloria Nixon-John, author of the book The Killing Jar. Gloria, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
She will speak at Barnes & Noble in Bowling Green tonight at 7 Central as part of the Kentucky Live series presented by WKU Libraries.